Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, we analyze the Tulsi Gabbard versus Hillary Clinton feud. We dive into the new Iowa poll that shows Pete Buttigieg surging. And finally, we do some unique culture analysis of the top grossing film, The Joker. This is Charlie Kirk, host of the Charlie Kirk Show, your home for conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Give us those 5-star ratings. Leave us a review. 5 stars. Help us out. Buckle up. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
All right, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. Some news broke over the weekend on Friday, which kind of goes to show the civil war that is brewing in the Democrat Party that we have been forecasting for some time. It is coming to fruition. And what happened was the failed presidential candidate from 2016, the person who lost a very winnable election that raised more money than basically any other Democrat or any other person running for the presidency in recent history, lost to President Donald Trump. That, of course, is Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton goes on a podcast, I think it's the David Plouffe podcast, who was a former Barack Obama staffer, actually Barack Obama confidant and kind of in that inner kitchen cabinet of President Obama. Hillary Clinton goes on his pre-recorded podcast and talks extemporaneously about Tulsi Gabbard and Jill Stein. The first thing that just struck me about this, and you're going to hear the sound in a second, is why didn't they just edit this out? Why did she allow this actually to go without being edited or removed? Because Hillary Clinton goes pretty aggressive against Congresswoman Gabbard. So let's play the clip here. Hillary Clinton goes straight after Tulsi Gabbard. And by the way, this sound is making huge shockwaves. This sound is going all over the internet and all over the news cycle. In fact, it was trending on Twitter almost all weekend.
I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. She's the favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far.
So that was Hillary on David Plouffe's podcast, former campaign manager for Barack Obama in 2008. And so she implied it was Tulsi Gabbard. And then later, so the Clinton spokesman, Nick Merrill, confirmed that Hillary Clinton was indeed talking about Tulsi Gabbard. So just so you understand what we're talking about, Hillary Clinton, the failed candidate in 2016, Hillary Clinton, whose campaign, by the way, paid for opposition research in collusion with British and Russian sources, the very thing that she's accusing Tulsi Gabbard of doing, now says that Tulsi Gabbard is the favorite of the Russians and is a Russian puppet. So look, Tulsi Gabbard is a very strict non-interventionist. Now, so I have some sympathy for what Congresswoman Gabbard believes in some aspect, which is I do think that there is a bipartisan agreement to continue to put American troops in the Middle East with no goal in sight, endless war. I do favor a more restrained foreign policy, but Congresswoman Gabbard goes as far to say some things about Bashar al-Assad in Syria that I would never say. She goes as far to say that we should lift all sanctions against Iran. I do not hold that view. She believes that America generally in the Middle East and generally across the world has been a force of negativity. I can see that argument in certain interventions. I think the Iraq war is a mistake, and I think the permanent occupation in Afghanistan was a mistake. And so then Congresswoman Gabbard responds on Twitter where she says, great, thank you, at Hillary Clinton, you, the queen of warmongers, the embodiment of corruption and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democrat Party for so long, has finally come out from behind the curtain. From the day I announced my candidacy, there has been a concerted campaign to destroy my reputation. We wondered who was behind it and why. Now we know. It was always you, through your proxies and powerful allies in the corporate media and war machine. Afraid of the threat I pose, it's now clear that this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly. Well, she definitely didn't hold anything back, but there's something that everyone is missing. There's something, there's an analysis about this Tulsi and Hillary feud that no one in the mainstream press is focusing on. In fact, they're just talking about how Hillary Clinton said the thing about Russia, but they're missing something bigger and something more important. I'm going to tell you exactly what that is. But first, I want to talk to you about a super exciting product that we at The Charlie Kirk Show just absolutely appreciate. In fact, Mr. Producer is wearing the product right now, and that is Vincero watches. So if you're a guy, you need a watch. And if you know a guy, you need to buy this watch for that guy. Therefore, everyone listening to this podcast needs to buy a Vincero watch because you're either a guy or you know a guy. I'm not going to assume your gender. We wouldn't do that. By the way, you should go back in the archives and listen to There Are Two Genders podcast. So Vincero watches create exceptionally crafted watches, and they sell them at a fair price. Each watch is painstakingly handcrafted for absolute quality. They come at a fraction of the price of other luxury watches of this same look and feel. Vincero claims to be the best at the value in their industry, and guess what? We agree with them. An exclusive deal just for our partners at Vincero. They're offering 15% off your entire order with the code KIRK, K-I-R-K. Just head to VinceroWatches.com and use the code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for 15% off. For daily wear, special occasions, or around the office, a classic wristwatch is something every man needs because they establish the person who's wearing them, and guess what? That's you, as the most ambitious, most interesting person in the room. When you've got on a nice watch, it changes the way you carry yourself, the way you feel, and therefore the way people look at you. So don't forget, Vincero has free worldwide shipping. Whether you are a watch connoisseur or looking for your first timepiece, a Vincero watch is going to exceed your expectations and make you feel more confident. Remember, my listeners get an extra 15% off just to use the code KIRK when you check out. That's K-I-R-K when you check out. So go to VinceroWatches.com. That's V-I-N-C-E-R-O watches.com and use the code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for 15% off your entire order. And they've had styles that I announced sell out before, so before you do anything else, do yourself a huge favor. Go pick out your new favorite accessory. Again, use that code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for 15% off. Do it now, V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com, KIRK, for 15% off your entire order. All right, so the Tulsi-Hillary feud. Here's what everyone is missing. People think that Hillary Clinton is having a hard time getting over the 2016 election. That's totally true. It's perpetual sore loser syndrome, and she just can't get over it. She really believes that she should be president of the United States. She believes that she won the election despite her winning the popular vote, which means absolutely nothing. She lost the Electoral College. It wasn't because of Russia interference. In fact, if there was anyone that colluded with Russia, it was Hillary and Bill Clinton, who sold out American uranium to Russia in exchange for cash. Bill Clinton, who spoke to a Russia-connected bank for $500,000 on uranium for a 30-minute speech. If there is anyone who's actually colluded with the Russians, who oversaw the Russia reset, Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State. But here's what everyone is missing. Guess what? Hillary Clinton and Tulsi Gabbard agree on everything. They think that the minimum wage should be $15 an hour. They believe in no restrictions at all for abortion. They think that President Donald Trump should be impeached. They think Planned Parenthood is the greatest non-government organization, NGO, in the history of the planet. They agree on the size and scope of government. They agree on Medicare for All. They agree that climate change is the greatest existential threat to our country. They agree on the Green New Deal. They think we should spend $93 trillion on trains to Hawaii, which wouldn't make any sense for Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. But what makes Hillary Clinton go out of her way on a podcast with another Democrat operative to attack Tulsi Gabbard? It's because the Democrats are the party of war. It's because the Democrat establishment, the Hillary Clinton Democrat establishment, is the party of perpetual foreign occupation in the Middle East. The only thing that Tulsi Gabbard disagrees with Hillary Clinton, the only thing is that she wants to end these foreign wars. And guess what? President Donald Trump is also going out of his way to end these foreign wars. He's doing everything he can to withdraw successfully from Afghanistan and negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban. He withdraws 50 troops. That's it. 50 troops. In fact, it was only 18 troops at the latest analysis. 18 human beings. We withdraw 18 human beings from northern Syria. And that is what causes Nancy Pelosi to get on a plane and fly all the way to Jordan. That's what causes her to go to Jordan to try to subvert and undermine President Donald Trump's America First foreign policy. Now, I understand there's a lot of complexity between Turkey and the Kurdish forces and Iraq and Bashar al-Assad. Senator Rand Paul made a great point on our podcast in our former episode. In fact, I want to play tape to that right now, where he talked about, wait, whose side are we going to be on?
It's not that I don't care about the Kurds. I do, but I care mostly about my oath to the Constitution, which says we don't go to war without a vote. And I think if we had a vote on war, it's not clear who we would actually be fighting against. Our NATO ally, Turkey, Assad, regime change, occupying Syria would be a much bigger war than we even had in Iraq, where we lost 5,000 soldiers. So I'm not for more war over there. I'm with President Trump on this.
So that was Senator Rand Paul commenting on the complex situation in northern Syria. But here's what it goes down to philosophically, is that Hillary Clinton being a statist and a collectivist, the one government program that she wants to continue to see expanded is the idea of an American empire abroad. Hillary Clinton supported regime change unsuccessfully in Libya. Hillary Clinton voted for the Iraq War in 2003. Hillary Clinton supported the continued foreign occupation of Afghanistan. Hillary Clinton has been invested in the Middle East, in the idea of America never withdrawing at all from the Middle East. So my perspective on America's involvement in the Middle East is that now that America's energy independent, now that America is able to export more oil than import oil, after Saudi Arabian oil sites, Saudi Arabian oil refineries were bombed by the Iranians, essentially they were through proxies in Yemen, but they were bombed by the Iranians. We barely saw oil prices go up because America now controls the international oil market. So my perspective when it comes to foreign policy in the Middle East is that we should withdraw our presence significantly from the Middle East and reposition all of our forces and all of our attention to China. China is the greatest enemy and the greatest adversary of the West. I use the word enemy. Some people think that's a little too harsh, but ask yourself the question, does a friend put spies into your country? Does a friend attack your cyber grid? Does a friend put Confucius Institutes into your own universities, which people, even the FBI director, Christopher Wray, has said pose a national security threat to our country? I use the word enemy. I use it intentionally because they have declared soft war on the United States. They've declared economic war. They've declared cultural war. And you saw it with how the NBA capitulated to the National Basketball Association. LeBron James' bizarre statement. In fact, let's play LeBron James' statement. His statement was so out of Beijing. And I was going to say so out of left field, but it's actually so out of Beijing. I think that's more fitting. Let's play LeBron James' statement.
We all talk about this freedom of speech. Yes, we all do have freedom of speech. But at times, there are ramifications for the negative that can happen when you're not thinking about others and you're only thinking about yourself. So I don't believe, I don't want to get into a word or sentence feud with Daryl. With Daryl Morey, but I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand, and he spoke, and so many people could have been harmed, not only financially but physically, emotionally, spiritually. So just be careful what we tweet and we say and what we do. Even though yes, we do have freedom of speech, but there can be a lot of negative that comes with that too.
So the NBA at first doubled down on their pro-China position, but now they're backtracking a little bit because of people like you and because of a bipartisan backlash. And I have made this argument before. Donald Trump has some amazing long-lasting legacies, but the one that I think even Democrats and even far left-wingers will agree that will be one of his most significant legacies is waking up our country to the threat of China. He is the first president to actually take a decisive and courageous stand against the growing threat to China. Even Senator Chuck Schumer has come out in support of President Donald Trump taking a stand against China economically, culturally, and politically. And so look, the Democrats are not just the party of perpetual war. They're the party of building an inefficient, bureaucratic, and corrupt empire in the Middle East. It seems that that is the one policy position that Tulsi Gabbard holds that drives former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton kind of off the wall. Now, look, I don't agree with Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard on everything in the Middle East. I do appreciate a more restrained foreign policy position, but she seems to have a very bizarre pro-Iranian twist. In fact, she thinks that we should lift the sanctions against Iran. I don't hold that position. She thinks that Bashar al-Assad is someone that should be understood and listened to. I think Bashar al-Assad is a murderous dictator. Our position on the Charlie Kirk Show here is Saudi Arabia, Iran, Syria, Iraq. It's a mess. Let's get out. Like, it's a mess between all the different tribes in the Middle East. Let's stop selling them arms, let's be more restrained, and let's focus on China. China is the threat. These countries in the Middle East do not pose an existential threat to the United States. We should not lessen the heel of the boot on Iran while Iran continues to fund external proxies against the United States. And so we take a more nuanced position here. I think Tulsi Gabbard goes full isolationist. I'm not going to say that she's funded by any of these countries, that she's a puppet of them. She just, I think, gives the Iranian mullahs and the evil Iranian leaders. Again, there's a distinction between the leaders of Iran and the people of Iran. The people of Iran, the Persian people, are a wonderful people. In fact, they're actually an inherently secular people. And I want to make this point. Mr. Producer at the Charlie Kirk Show reminded me of a point I make a lot. So I take a more nuanced, moderate position when it comes to foreign policy. I'm not all the way Tulsi Gabbard isolationist, close on every base and retreat from the world. And I'm not build the American empire, Hillary Clinton, Bill Kristol, invade every country that looks weird at us and just like, okay, troops must go there. I do believe that America as a benevolent superpower has a place in the world. But my biggest complaint about war, my number one complaint, is that it becomes an endless, bureaucratic, big government program where the mission is not complete. So right after 9/11 in 2001, when America was looking for retribution for 3,000 innocent civilians killed on 9/11, we got more done in 90 days after 9/11 in Afghanistan when we brought in special forces, strategic bombing, Navy SEALs, and Green Berets in Afghanistan going after targeted terrorist cells than in 19 years of foreign occupation in Afghanistan. The United States military, as a big government program, should not be about foreign occupying lands. It doesn't work. It's like creating the Department of Education in Afghanistan. It wastes money. It bleeds the U.S. Treasury. So I am not against holding our enemies accountable. I am not against effectively going after people that wish us harm and that have attacked the United States. I would make the argument, though, and I've made this argument before, that it was not Afghanistan that practiced 9/11. First of all, and it's been proven in a lawsuit, Iran gave safe haven to the terrorists of 9/11, and Iran should still be held accountable for their involvement in 9/11. And also, it's super important to remember, and again, this is the Tulsi Gabbard mentioned this quite often, and so does Senator Rand Paul, 15 out of 19 of the hijackers on 9/11 were Saudi Arabian. There have been court documents that have also shown that Saudi Arabia gave safe haven to the 9/11 hijackers, and they have never been held accountable for what they did on 9/11. So it's fair to say that both countries in the Middle East participated in 9/11. So why the heck are we still sending troops to Saudi Arabia? We're sending troops here. Let's stop picking and choosing winners and losers in the Middle East. We don't need their oil. We don't need their energy. But it goes back to my point here, though, is that the trend of the Republican Party currently, led by our great president Donald Trump, is a de-escalation of conflict and a more restrained foreign policy stance in the Middle East. However, Hillary Clinton, she gets worried and she gets anxious when she sees American troops coming home from the Middle East. She starts freaking out because Democrats and the Democrat Party are the party of war. That's why they go after Tulsi Gabbard so viciously. That's why they attack her. It's also important to remember that Tulsi Gabbard resigned as DNC vice chair on February 28, 2016, in order to endorse Senator Bernie Sanders for the nomination. She was the first congresswoman to endorse Sanders and later gave the nominating speech putting his name forward at the 2016 Democrat convention. She's been always a rebel. I'm sure Hillary Clinton still has some anxiety towards that and looks at her. But look, she's a veteran. I don't agree with her on the Bashar al-Assad thing. She kind of loses me on that when she starts to talk about affectionately about murderous dictators. I don't agree with her on lifting sanctions against Iran, but I do agree that we should withdraw forces from Syria appropriately. I don't think that we should get involved in these tribal conflicts, and I totally agree that the Afghan war needs to be ended today. It's been a costly, bureaucratic, winless war. What does victory look like? You should never get involved in anything in business, politics, or in the military. You cannot define what success looks like. And saying hearts and minds are going to be changed in the future, that is not what a foreign occupation should look like. So Tulsi Gabbard represents an anti-war faction of the Democrat Party that is bubbling up. Be prepared. This Democrat civil war is just heating up. In fact, we have a prediction that has come true here in the Charlie Kirk Show. I'm going to tell you about it in just 1 second. But first, real-life gunfights and robberies aren't like the movies. Roughly 80% of all shots fired in self-defense will miss their targets, even when they're fired by trained gun handlers. Did you know over 60% of the time the assault victim is violently ambushed and the average attack only lasts 3 seconds? So what does that tell us? Number one, you have to have a concrete self-defense plan in place. And number two, you have to practice. And that's exactly why the United States Concealed Carry Association, amazing organization, and you guys should join it, was founded. When you join the United States Concealed Carry Association, you'll get instant access to industry-leading self-defense education, training, and legal protection. You'll have thousands of hours of life-saving resources from the USCCA award-winning self-defense team right at your fingertips. Plus, this week, they're giving away 19 free chances to win $1,000 for a defensive item of your choice when you activate your risk-free membership. I put my total name and support behind this organization. You guys got to join. If you own a gun, you have to be a member of this organization. It's an effective, important insurance policy, not the insurance policy that Peter Strzok talked about, but an actual insurance policy. So text Kirk, K-I-R-K, to 87222, that's 87222 right now, to learn more and get your 19 free chances to win. Text K-I-R-K, that's Kirk, to 87222. Take out your phone, type in 87222 to claim your entries and learn more. That's Kirk to 87222. So the Democrat civil war is brewing and it's only going to escalate further. So last week on the Charlie Kirk Show, I made a prediction and Mr. Producer kind of looked at me funny, but it's actually turning out to be true. Here on the Charlie Kirk Show, promises made, promises kept, predictions proven correct. Unlike all the cable news guys who said Donald Trump will never win, we actually make correct predictions. We saw the plunging of Biden and the surging of Warren. And guess what? The surging of Pete Buttigieg. Let's play sound of last week on the Charlie Kirk Show. And by the way, before I go any further, go to your podcast provider, type in the Charlie Kirk Show. If you're not yet subscribed, press subscribe. Go down, please. Give us those 5-star ratings and leave a review. We have another AMA coming up. Ask me anything. In fact, we might do one this week at the tail end of the show. Go press, go type in Charlie Kirk Show, press subscribe, and leave a review. Let's play sound last week of me predicting the rise of Pete Buttigieg. Play tape. If I had to say, hey, this person has the highest likelihood of getting hot in Iowa, and no one is talking about this guy, but he's had a good amount of press appeal and hasn't had a big blow up, I would have to say that guy is Pete Buttigieg. He has a Midwestern appeal. He has raised a tremendous amount of money. He has a great Iowa operation, and I think he's going to have his Iowa moment. And so look, people say, Charlie, how do you actually predict some of these things correctly? It's because of the work we do at Turning Point USA. TPUSA.com. If you guys want to get engaged or get involved, go to TPUSA.com, start a chapter, attend an event, or give us some money. I interact firsthand with the left-wing activists. I talk to them. I listen to them. I see the direction of the Democrat Party, and I'm able to see kind of what they want. And I know that there has been an appetite, and their anxiety of beating Donald Trump is going to new heights. And so someone who's more moderate, more nuanced, more polished, with a very good Iowa operation is someone who becomes more and more attractive. And so Pete Buttigieg has jumped 7 points in a recent Suffolk USA Today poll. Joe Biden is doing way worse than expected. Elizabeth Warren is now the front runner. We've been predicting that for quite some time. But Pete Buttigieg, people who thought he was out of the race, had a really, I guess, strong debate. I say guess because I watch this stuff and I couldn't imagine anyone who finds any of these candidates appealing. So I have to kind of put myself in other people's shoes. This is the ultimate empathetic exercise, trying to understand Democrat politics. But still, we try to analyze it and tell you where things are going. Maybe there will be a Warren Buttigieg ticket formed at some point. But again, I kind of get upset because all these cable news pundits have been talking about like an inevitable Biden nomination for 5 months now. We've never had that analysis. In fact, we have been stridently against it. The fact that Buttigieg is surging and Warren is surging, it shows that the Democrat Party wants someone younger. They want new ideas. They want a woman. They might want someone of color, or they might want someone who's LGBT, someone who represents a different type of candidate. Let's put it that way. Someone who has not been on the national stage before. Pete Buttigieg speaks the Iowa nomenclature a lot better. He's from South Bend. And I talked about this on the prior Charlie Kirk Show episode where I said that Pete Buttigieg, he infuses scripture. He talks about morals. He talks about values. He's against universal gun confiscation. Him and Robert Francis O'Rourke, the fate Hispanic Irishman, overly privileged congressman, who might be the person who irritates me the most running for the presidency, is Robert Francis O'Rourke, who tries to convince immigrants who had to swim 90 miles from Cuba that they live in a horrible racist country. This guy is an absolute fool. Let's just put it that way. He's a fool. He's a fool. And he has to convince first-generation immigrants that we live in a horrible country. Hey, just I want to remind you how racist of a country you live in. And these first-generation immigrants are like, no, I'm actually really thankful we live here. I don't think it's that racist. But you're like a seventh-generation Irishman from El Paso who has a fake Hispanic name. And you're telling me that it's a racist country. In fact, let's play sound of Robert Francis O'Rourke saying that we're still a racist country. He said this over the weekend. He said, to the core, we're racist to our core.
Each of us is caught in an inextricable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. This country, though we may not be in El Paso, Texas, is still racist at its foundation, at its core, and throughout this system.
Again, I hate to give the guy that has 2% in the polls this much credence and credibility, but this is what I have to deal with every single day on college campuses. Overly privileged, suburban educated, sixth or seventh generation Americans that are trying to convince first generation people of color that this country is horrible and racist and bigoted and backwards. Drives me, it infuriates me, because he would have something to say if maybe he was a first-generation immigrant and he's saying how horrible this country is, then we'd actually have a conversation about it. It's still an incorrect analysis. But the fact that he's a fake Hispanic pandering to America to try to convince himself that he's a minority when he's not a minority. His name's Robert Francis O'Rourke. He has tons of driving under influence. He's a drunk driver who has overly privileged trust fund baby from El Paso who wants open borders, yet he lives in gated communities. Total universal gun confiscation that walks around with armed guards. Wants to get rid of private schools, yet he sends all of his kids to private schools. He wants to get rid of tax-exempt status for churches that don't believe in same-sex marriage. This guy is as radical and as left-wing as it gets for no other reason than political pandering, and he likes the sound of applause after he goes to rallies. Donald Trump draws 40,000 people for a rally. He draws 400 people. Anyway, Robert Francis O'Rourke, we enjoy having you around so we can demonstrate the direction of the Democrat Party, where it's going. However, Pete Buttigieg is surging. He's surging the Midwest. And keep your eye on a Buttigieg-Warren confrontation at some point, because that's really the debate that's going to happen. And by the way, keep your eyes on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, and Ilhan Omar, three people out of the squad. Where is Ayanna Pressley? Ayanna Pressley's missing. She's not in the squad anymore. Remember, whatever happens on college campuses will soon happen in the halls of Congress. They endorsed Bernie Sanders over the weekend. He drew the largest crowd of any Democrat running for the presidency. I think it was only over 30,000 people or something crazy, 25,000 people. Again, I don't know why 25,000 people would voluntarily spend time to go support Senator Bernie Sanders for the presidency in New York City. That is beyond me, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gave what some called a very inspiring speech. I called it a very troubling speech because she represents all the college kids that, not all the college kids, I shouldn't say that, I should nuance that. There's so much support for what we talk about. She represents the base of the Democrat Party, the very same base that Senator Kamala Harris tries to pander to when she smears Turning Point USA, University of Nevada, Reno. The AOC is basically the Speaker of the House of the radical left-wing Democrats. She is the kind of puppet Speaker of the House, by the way. She pushed impeachment. She pushes Green New Deal. Senator Bernie Sanders overly panders to that base, which to me is just very bizarre. Again, we are taking a poll right now in the comment section of the Charlie Kirk Show on the podcast feed. Bolshevik Bernie Sanders or breadline Bernie Sanders? Please comment which one you like best, because we'll be talking about the results very, very soon. But the direction of the Democrat Party is skewing much more in the direction of Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren. Pete Buttigieg is making a bet that he can get support from who? Buttigieg is the only person that thinks he can get support from Joe Biden. I think it's a wise play. I think Buttigieg is getting good advice. He's getting good counsel. There have been articles written that David Axelrod, off the record, has been counseling Pete Buttigieg. And I think that some of these people that are a little bit wary of supporting Trump, a little bit wary of supporting a moderate Republican, will be more likely to support Pete Buttigieg. Again, we are being proven correct on the Charlie Kirk Show. I think Warren and Buttigieg are the most likely to either combine forces or to confront each other ahead of the Iowa caucuses coming up in Iowa in early February. Guess what? We're coming into the home stretch here, guys. We're less than 4 months away, almost four and a half months away. That's going to happen like this. We are going to have elections very, very soon. This field is going to winnow. You're going to see a lot of people get very, very desperate very quickly on the Charlie Kirk Show. So a lot still to happen in the Democrat primary. I think Pete Buttigieg is going to try to win over a lot more of those blue-collar voters, which is a liability for Senator Warren. There might be a combined forces sooner than later to try to defeat Joe Biden. But Senator Bernie Sanders getting endorsed by the squad and drawing these crowds, boy, does this throw a very interesting wrench into the entire kind of machinery of the Democrat Party. Because there was a bet that was made that Senator Sanders was going to kind of go into the sunset and stay around 10% after he had that heart attack. Him drawing that crowd, him getting endorsed by the squad this early, makes it a very, very interesting and more complex race. But if you add up Warren, if you add up Buttigieg, and if you add up Sanders, they far outnumber Biden's support. Biden's path to victory. Do you know what Biden's path to victory is? Get them all to fight each other for long enough and they stay enemies for so long that Biden gets to be the consensus candidate. I don't see that happening. He's not drawing the crowds. And by the way, have you noticed the lack of institutional pundit support for Joe Biden on cable news? Have you noticed the lack of people standing up for Joe Biden? Have you noticed? I mean, the fact that they even had to interview Hunter Biden last week shows that the machinery of the Democrat Party is getting a little bit exhausted to have to defend the corruption of Joe Biden. Lots still to come. Our predictions are being proven correct. And so two final thoughts. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the individual from New York who's constantly wrong but never in doubt, had this sound where she said, we're all on the same team. She met with Senator Warren and then endorsed Senator Sanders. She's hedging her bets a little bit. Let's play that sound.
You know, I think she's a fabulous candidate. And so, frankly, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren, and myself are all on the same team in the party.
Congresswoman Cortez says that Senator Warren is probably still a viable pick. And the other important point to mention is that Joe Biden is burning cash. He's sending out fundraising emails like it's going out of style. He spent millions of dollars on private jets. He has low cash on hand, and these other candidates are raking it in. Joe Biden is a floundering campaign. He will not do well in these coming months. It is about to become a very difficult time for Joe Biden's already troubling political career. And you heard it here first on the Charlie Kirk Show. We've been making this prediction now for 5 months straight. We've been telling you that Joe Biden is not going to be the Democrat nominee. Stay tuned for more from the Charlie Kirk Show. And guess what? I'm going to tell you about the number one movie of the year that everyone is talking about, The Joker. I'm going to give you some cultural political analysis. But first, a recent Gallup survey shows Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime. More than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. It's amazing. According to studies, just over 10% of break-ins are planned beforehand. The rest are spur-of-the-moment, crimes of opportunity. In other words, they are totally and completely random. Did you know most break-ins happen between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m., right in the middle of the day? According to the FBI, the average loss in a burglary is over $2,000. That can be so hard to recover from. There are over 2 million burglaries reported every single year. That's one every 13 seconds. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes have home security, maybe because most companies really don't make it that easy. I know for one, when I try to get home security, it's confusing, expensive, it takes too much time, and it's a total hassle. That's why Simply Safe is my top choice. All the property I care about have Simply Safe. Simply Safe protects your whole home, every window, every door, with 24/7 monitoring at just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. They make it easy on you. There's no contract, no hidden fees or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. It's easy to order and easy to set up, usually under an hour. And around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. So here's what you do. Visit simplysafe.com/Charlie. Go to simplysafe.com/Charlie. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You got nothing to lose. Go now and be sure to go to simplysafe.com/Charlie so they know our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. All right, spoiler alert, everyone. If you haven't yet seen this movie, then just go see it. Or if you have no interest in it or you have an interest in it, I'm going to dive into the entire narrative of the movie Joker. So I saw it a couple days ago, and it's evidently, I think it's the number one top grossing R-rated film of all time. Is that right? Or it's on pace? Or it's on pace. It's on track to be the number one top grossing R-rated film of all time. And so look, I'm a huge Batman fan, especially the three Christian Bale Batman films, which of course were Batman Begins, Dark Knight, and Dark Knight Rises. Is that right? Those are the three. Which, of course, the first one was about Batman's rise from kind of a, let's just say, destitute Bruce Wayne turning into Batman, embracing his dark fear, and he battles Ra's al Ghul, and you kind of get the idea of where he gets the affinity or the rejection of bats. You embrace that which you are most fearful from, and you overcome that obstacle. That is the hero's journey, of course. Now, mind you, we talk a lot on the Charlie Kirk Show that the story of Western civilization is the hero's journey, which is, oh, it's basically this, which is you lose your parents at a young age, you're raised by a somewhat father figure, an uncle. So think Star Wars, think Lord of the Rings, think Harry Potter. What do they all have in common? These are male figures that are always, they lose their fathers at a young age, they lose their family, or they're raised by what? They're raised by uncles. All three movies, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Star Wars, they're all raised by uncles. And they're kind of, they're raised in very innocent places. They're raised in Tatooine, they're raised in the Shire, or they're raised under, literally under stairs. And of course, then they overcome it. That's the story of the Western, that's the story of Western civilization, the story of overcoming obstacles, overcoming adversity, that. And of course, what's interesting about all three of them, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Star Wars, what do they eventually have to do? They have to overcome the what? The darkness within them, right? So overcome the ring, that is the temptation within them. They have to overcome the scar, which is, of course, is Voldemort, he who must not be named, or they must overcome the temptation of going to the dark side. Essentially, that's in Star Wars. So anyway, that now that we talk about that a lot. If that has never been articulated to you, and all of a sudden you're like, my goodness, I never realized that. Well, you're welcome. So anyway, the Batman is a very similar story where Christian Bale, Bruce Wayne as Batman, in Batman Begins, goes through and overcomes Ra's al Ghul. Again, this whole idea of confronting the person who trained you is also something that is a unique story. It's not totally the hero's journey, but it's something that you see a lot. You saw that somewhat in Star Wars in the early episodes, in Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, which of course is Anakin Skywalker when he becomes Darth Vader, confronting Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the Master gets proven victorious, but not really, because he has to see his protege become the most menacing figure on the planet. But anyway, Batman Begins is kind of that very similar story where Bruce Wayne has to confront Ra's al Ghul, his master, his trainer, and he ends up being victorious. Second movie is my favorite, which is The Dark Knight. So The Dark Knight, the first scene of The Dark Knight is what? Anyone? Is the Joker robbing a bank, right? Breaking open a window, and it's super sophisticated. It's this amazing, elaborate robbery, but it's so sinister. It's so dark. Why is it dark? Well, it's dark because he kills everybody. So he incentivizes everyone to kill each other in the robbery of the bank. So essentially, there's only one person left with the loot, and then the Joker kills it. It's really sophisticated, though, and the Joker is not just dark, but he's also playing multidimensional chess. And so all throughout this whole movie, The Batman The Dark Knight, which was one of the most successful movies of our generation, I went and saw it four times when it came out. I saw it four times. I have seen it well over 50 times. It is one of the most amazing pieces of cinema. I know, in fact, one of the things that we say all the time in The Charlie Kirk Show is, here we go, is actually one of the sayings from Batman Dark Knight Rises. Anyway, so there's so many different themes than Dark Knight Rises. Again, I'm using this as a kind of a foreshadow of me talking about the Joker, because it bothers me because I know that movie so well, and then I see the Joker and I feel as if I'm seeing two different character lines, is that the Joker that is established in the movie The Dark Knight Rises is a Joker that, yes, is estranged from society, yes, had a troubled upbringing, but he was also a mastermind. This guy was freaking brilliant. In fact, one of his major missions was to try to make Harvey Dent turn into Two-Face, make someone who is righteous, someone with a morally correct vision and a morally righteous cause go into the dark side, that battle of the individual. And so the Joker does everything from bombing hospitals to turning civilians against each other. And remember, one of the most famous scenes in the movie, Dark Knight Rises, is when you have this huge pile of money and he burns the money. And that famous scene is where he says, some people just want to watch the world burn. And just to be clear, I'm interchanging the titles. The Dark Knight is the second Batman film. That's where the Joker appears, and essentially Batman goes up against the Joker. And so the Joker is essentially first, it's a long movie. It goes through many different kind of episodes within the chapter. The first episode is the brilliance of the Joker being this international vigilante kind of crime figure, if you will, who's able to consolidate all of Gotham's crime families together through a very nihilistic way, where he turns people against each other. The second episode of that is the Joker turning Harvey Dent from a prosecutor that goes after everything bad into a bad guy himself. And the third episode of The Dark Knight is the Batman actually fighting the Joker. That's where you get that famous scene on the streets of Chicago where they shut down LaSalle Street. You remember what I'm talking about? They shut down and they actually flipped the semi-truck. Boom! And they actually did that. And I remember when it happened in Chicago. Anyway, the type of individual that is portrayed in the second movie of Batman in the modern-day Christian Bale movies. Now, mind you, there were all these other Jokers, too. Jack Nicholson played the Joker, but that was a different type of Joker. He was much more affable and much more funny and much more comedic and much more happy. This is a different... The type of Joker that Heath Ledger played was a dark figure. This guy was someone who wanted to watch the world burn. Okay, so that's the Joker that I thought. So I watched this movie, The Joker, and there's so many different interpretations of it. Seems that everyone equally hates this film. Did I hate it? Not really, because I expected it. So first of all, it starts, for those of you that have seen it, you understand this, but it starts with a guy that obviously has serious mental issues and a guy that has uncontrollable laughter. And so first of all, there's so many different themes. One of the big themes of the movie is the idea of stairs. If you notice that the idea of stairs happen a lot in the movie, going upstairs, going downstairs, dancing downstairs. So the idea of the metaphor of stairs go way, way back to Greek times. Stairs can either be the ascent towards higher purpose or the descent towards madness, okay? So that was used intentionally. Joaquin Phoenix, who was best known in The Gladiator, also was in some sort of firefighter movie once, if I remember correctly. Anyway, he was in Gladiator, which is one of my favorite movies. My top three favorite movies of all time, by the way, is Lord of the Rings, Gladiator, and Braveheart. We can get into that at a later time, but they're all great movies. What do Braveheart and Gladiator have in common? The hero dies at the end, therefore it's a realistic story. So anyway, and the purpose lives past them. Nevertheless, Joaquin Phoenix is a little bit of an interesting guy. In the movie Gladiator, he plays Commodus, which is the son of the last great emperor of the Roman Empire, Marcus Aurelius, who, of course, was the founder of Stoicism and wrote the famous book Meditations, which was one of the original authors of the ideas that built Western civilization. He was the kind of crazy son of Marcus Aurelius who would approve or disapprove of gladiators. Anyway, we're not talking about the Gladiator. So anyway, Joaquin Phoenix plays the Joker. So he actually had to lose a lot of weight for this, and it was so noticeably skinny. So why was he noticeably skinny? Well, of course, this was a metaphor for his lack of affection and his lack of attention. So not only was he physically starved, but the director wanted to make the physical representation that he was starved for attention, he was starved for love, and he did that through just being so emaciated that he couldn't possibly have anything to hold on to. That's basically why, one of the reasons why they went over and above to show how skinny he was. And so, look, the story goes through, it's a difficult film to watch, let's just put it that way. It's a difficult film to watch because you start to feel sorry for this figure about halfway through, and then you start to cheer for this figure, which is really tough, but then you don't. So there's a scene in the movie where you cheer for the madness. So there's a scene in the movie where there are three guys that, of course, they try to make them see the archetypical capitalists. They work for Wayne Enterprises, and they're all dressed in nice suits with gold watches, slicked back hair, and it's in a subway, and they first start picking on a young woman, and then the Joker, whose name is Arthur in the movie, starts laughing uncontrollably. He can't control his laugh. It's his only way to cope with a descending chaotic world, and the three capitalists, if you will, I use that word because that's basically how they're portrayed, the three capitalists come up to the Joker and start picking on him, and then you kind of start saying, stand up for yourself, come on, you have a gun. And you don't say that, but you start to say that. When are you going to... And boom, 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 he kills all three of them, but he kills two of them. But then he goes over and above self-defense, and he descends into murder. When he chases down the last guy to the stairs, and he doesn't just shoot him when he walks away, he shoots him execution style. And that's the first time you see him have full and total control of his life, when he descends into retaliation against the capitalist class. So here's what bothered me about the film. So Thomas Wayne is so obviously tried to be portrayed as Donald Trump. It's so obvious. I picked it out immediately. A lot of people don't agree with this analysis, but he's the billionaire of New York City. New York City and Gotham have always been interchanged as the same city. He's running for office to try to save the people. He has big businesses, a lot of people that work for him. He's well-known on TV, public figure. Anyway, so that's so obviously Donald Trump. And he's running for mayor, which is a pretty important position in this mythical world called Gotham. So anyway, Arthur, there's a really weird subplot of this movie where Arthur, or the Joker, his mom, who's totally nuts, is convinced that he's actually Thomas Wayne's son, which actually would make Bruce Wayne and Arthur brothers, interestingly enough. But you can make them make the argument they're metaphorical brothers because they have two different ways to cope with suffering, right? So the Joker had something really, really bad happen to him, and so did Bruce Wayne. So here's the real story of Batman that's not being told, and this is what really bothers me about this movie, is that everyone has suffering happen to them. So Joker has suffering happen to him, has estranged parents, gets abused as a kid. Bruce Wayne has something really bad happen to him, too. Both his parents were killed in cold blood at the age of 8, and he has to witness it. What does Bruce Wayne do? He embraces some darkness, and then becomes a hero. Joker descends into the madness. The problem is all throughout this movie, the idea of rebellion against the elite and a rebellion against the rich and rebellion against the people that have any sort of status is glorified and glamorized. It just is. The idea of wearing clown masks, the idea of wearing the Joker, there were resist signs that were shown many times throughout the film. Eat the Rich was shown on a newspaper. Again, I'm more astute to this than most, and so Mr. Producer is nodding his head, and we saw it. I thought this was an allegory for Antifa. I thought if I was an Antifa member, it would show me that there is meaning to this. And so in a metaphor, you show this, and you see this really simply, where you see the Joker in a place of being held accountable for his crimes in the police car, looking out, watching the world burning, and he's smiling at his creation. So his creation is what? Deconstructionism. What part of the American political process right now wants deconstructionism? Well, it's obviously the American left. I mean, the far left, I said radical left, far left, they essentially want to see the world not be what it is, and they want to uproot that world. By the way, the Antifa violence that happens in Portland, happens in San Francisco, is not held accountable. These people are not arrested. They're not held accountable. We had an interview with Andy Ngo on the Charlie Kirk Show. You can go back. He had a brain bleed. He's a gay minority journalist beaten in the streets. Zero people have been held accountable. Zero people have been arrested for what he did. So anyway, he's in the cop car, which is some semblance of justice, right? And what happens? He gets slammed by an ambulance. Cops die by other Antifa activists. I'm calling them Antifa activists. He gets lifted gently out of the cop car, almost like he's a hero, right? So mind you, the whole idea of being lifted, you think back to different movies. Think back to Gladiator. Think back to Braveheart. The kind of being raised up, almost the resurrection of the individual. That's what you do to heroes. You do that to heroes, right? You lift up gently. So the mob is lifting him up gently, and they lift him on the car. He spits out blood, which is a very repeated movie symbol for trying to be, I almost was dead and now I'm alive, you spit out blood. And then he gets on the car and kind of dances in a very strange, it's almost as if he's possessed dance, and he gets cheers, cheers, cheers. And of course, the final scene, of course, is him in the insane asylum where he says, you know, you wouldn't get it and all that. So here's a couple of questions. Is how much of this was actually in the Joker's head and how much of this actually happened? Because his relationship with the woman, I said the whole time this is not actually happening. This was in his head. I turned to the people I was in the movie with and I said, this is not actually happening. He's not actually with this woman. But here's the big thing. Here's what bothered me the most. And nobody talked about this. No one has done this analysis. Every movie needs a hero and every movie needs the villain. Who's the villain in this movie? It's not the Joker. He's not the villain. He's not the hero though. The part that is not talked about, but it's mentioned three times, is when he goes for help from government and the social safety net is cut. That is the underpinning argument. Think about it. So he, again, you have to see the movie to understand what I'm saying, but twice he goes to a dimly lit office to a very insincere type conversation with a woman who is employed by the Gotham City. The first time, it's kind of a sparing conversation. The second time, she notifies him, our funding is cut, I can no longer help you, you can't get your medication. What's the argument? Government's not doing enough. Government's not doing enough for these people. Third time it's mentioned, when he goes to the mental hospital and he tries to pull the files from for his mom. And he's like, well, we have services for people like you. And he said, didn't you hear? The funding's been cut. And he even pantomimes it. The funding's been cut. The funding's been cut. What are they really saying here? We need to grow government. Government needs to do more. It's the city that failed him. Therefore, the city must burn. This was making a subliminal argument that government must do more for the least of these in society. Not the church, not people helping people, not stronger families, but instead it was government. This is the not talked about analysis of the Joker, mentioned three times. It wasn't talking about fatherless absence. It didn't talk about, nowhere in the entire film, mind you, were there any sort of religious symbolism? Was there any sort of faith put into this? It was a very nihilistic, dark film. Mind you, the whole film was filmed through a actual physical lens, not a physical, but it was, you could tell they darkened down the lighting of the entire film intentionally. And so a couple more thoughts on this, and I could do a whole movie cinematic analysis, because I believe that politics is all fine, but it flows downstream from culture. So for example, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted out last week, tax the rich, right? That's what she said. Well, one word away is eat the rich. That was in this movie. And so I believe intentionally in this film, Mr. Wayne, who was shot cold-blooded in the street, was made to look like a younger Donald Trump. We in this country, we used to appreciate success. We used to talk about the benefits of success. This movie was about glamorizing class warfare. This movie was about the state did not do enough to help the least of these. And it didn't talk about how a father back in the house could have helped it. Now, that argument could have been made, but it wasn't proactively made. Instead, the subliminal message made three different times is, man, if only social services had more money. Man, if only social services had more money, Arthur wouldn't have become this genocidal, murderous maniac. And the left, the people that on the left, they're missing this. And by the way, you end up cheering for the Joker at some point, and then you kind of lose that whole kind of cheering. There's points in the film, though, where you're hoping he succeeds, where it is framed of him as the victim, that he's being picked on, that he's being laughed at, that he gets driven from his job, or he gets jumped, or he gets mugged, and you end up getting sympathy for this character. So wrapping it all together, this is my big complaint, though, with just kind of as a character arc. He was not at all, there was not one second, one moment where it made him look like a genius. In the second episode with Christian Bale, The Dark Knight, he looks like a genius. The Joker played by Heath Ledger looks like a genius. He looks like a strategic, multidimensional, underwater chess player, right? This Joker looks like someone who is errant and erratic and has no control over himself. And the most sophisticated thing he does in the whole film is bring a gun on set and shoot the equivalent of Jay Leno, essentially, is what Robert De Niro played in that film. There's so much more I can get into of different symbolism and allegories of the whole thing, but I think it was an allegory of Antifa. It only further divides the culture class warfare that's happening in this country of rich versus poor. And there is no way that anyone can make the argument that this film made a salient defense of strong families, strong communities, and strong churches. In fact, it made the argument that you need bigger government and that would help solve our problems. So we might do more of this. We enjoy this on The Charlie Kirk Show. It keeps people captivated. If you agree, please go to The Charlie Kirk Show on Apple Podcasts and type in your reviews. We'll do an AMA and type in your thoughts of the Joker. Give us 5 stars. Press subscribe. Get your friend to do the same. Please get involved. with Turning Point USA, the nation's largest conservative student organization focused on fighting for free enterprise, the Constitution, American exceptionalism on over 1,400 high school and college campuses across the country. We have an event coming up in South Florida in Palm Beach, December 18, 19, 2021. We have Ben Shapiro, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Candace Owens, Dan Crenshaw, Rand Paul, Mark Levin, just to name a few. That's tpusa.com/SAS. You guys got to attend. That's tpusa.com/SAS. Support our sponsors. Give us those five-star ratings. Leave a review. Head to charliekirk.com to support us in many other ways. Again, this is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show. We always enjoy giving you the rational, conservative, libertarian thought analysis. Till next time, thank you. This is Charlie Kirk signing off.
As always, a big thank you for listening to the show. We'd like to ask a small but very important favor of you. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time. We need you to complete a short survey, because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Just go to podcastone.com/survey, and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. The first 250 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to Amazon.com, and two grand prize winners will be selected at random to get $100 Amazon gift card. How about that? Free money. It's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to the needs of you as a loyal listener. Go to podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make some money along the way. From all of us here at Podcast One, thank you for being a dedicated listener.